Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings, welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. On today's podcast, we have with us Dominic Halsmer, Dean of the College of Science and Engineering at Oral Roberts University. Dr. Halsmer received his bachelor's and master's degree in aeronautical and astronautical engineering at Purdue University, and then he received his PhD in mechanical engineering from UCLA. He's a signer of our Descent from Darwinism list, and he's been teaching at Oral Roberts University since 1992. So, Dr. Halsmer, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, I'll give our listeners a little sneak peek at what's coming ahead. Dr. Halsmer recently published an article in the International Journal of Design and Nature and Ecodynamics titled The Coherence of an Engineered World, where he makes the case that our universe is engineered from the largest aspects of its architecture down to some of its most microscopic characteristics. And we're going to be talking about this paper with Dr. Halsmer in an upcoming podcast. But today, before we get into that, I wanted to give our listeners the opportunity to get to know Dr. Halsmer a little bit and interview him to find a little bit about his own scientific background and why he became a scientific skeptic of Darwinian evolution. So, Dr. Halsmer, I'd like to just start off with a question for you. What got you interested in science originally?
Well, I grew up out in the country on about 10 acres of land in rural Indiana with 12 brothers and sisters. And my dad was a great aviator and an inventor. And so we sort of followed in his footsteps. We had a small airport with a workshop in it, so there was a lot of opportunity to experiment with the laws of nature. But it was more than just science. It was also engineering that became fascinating to me, without even realizing it, I guess. In fact, the fields of science and engineering were very much entangled together in my upbringing. While we were inventing weird contraptions, we were also learning about how the world worked. You know, that's the best way to do education, is make it as fun as possible, and then the students don't even realize that they're learning. Of course, we were fascinated with flying, and we looked for interesting ways to harness the wind. My older brothers got the crazy idea of strapping a parachute to their backs and being pulled by a car until they became airborne. It turns out a bicycle comes in pretty handy at this point. It was kind of like a homemade kite, and it worked pretty well, until one of my brothers got dragged quite a ways through a soybean field. I was too young at the time to try it myself, but when I look back on it, this event and others like it had a profound impact on my thinking and on my mental development. A natural extension of this kind of childhood was to pursue a degree in science and engineering, and my parents encouraged me in this direction. They were very instrumental in my academic success. In fact, my mom wrote a book about my dad's life called Chosen to Fly, which is available on Amazon. They really provided us with a wonderful childhood.
So when you finally decided to study science, Dr. Halsmer, what scientific studies did you pursue?
Well, it would be more accurate to call them engineering studies, but of course, engineers take several science courses and learn how to apply scientific principles to solve problems. But I was fortunate enough to be right across the Wabash River from Purdue University. So I enrolled in a degree in aeronautical and astronautical engineering. I also signed up for their co-op program, where undergraduate students got to work for an engineering company every other semester after the freshman year. It takes an extra year to graduate, but I think it was worth it to do it in 5 years. I got on with the company called the Aerospace Corporation in El Segundo, California, and I tested out of some classes and ended up with a full 2 years of work experience under my belt. Now, you don't know a whole lot after just 1 year in college, and the folks at the Aerospace Corporation were very patient with me. They also allowed me the option of switching departments with every new work session. At that time, I didn't really know yet what I wanted to do, so I took advantage of this opportunity to gain experience in several areas. I worked in spacecraft guidance systems, propulsion systems, astrodynamics, and control systems. Seeing how all these systems interfaced and worked together in one spacecraft gave me an interest and a good foundation in systems engineering. By the time I got my BS degree, I had married Kate, and we both enjoyed working and living in Southern California, so I took a job with the Space and Comm Group of Hughes Aircraft Company. But we continued to travel back and forth across the country while I completed a master's degree in aero and astro engineering at Purdue. Hughes was generous enough to provide me with a master's fellowship, and my focus was on dynamics and control systems. But since it was a non-thesis master's degree, it only took a year and a half. I was pretty sure that I wanted to go on for a PhD eventually, and I didn't want to get bogged down in a master's thesis. So this worked out pretty well, but we got tired of moving back and forth, so I was glad to accept an offer to pursue a PhD at the University of California in Los Angeles in 1987. I continued to work part-time at Hughes in the area of spacecraft attitude dynamics and controls, but I was also enjoying being a teaching assistant at UCLA. I don't think I fully realized it at the time, but I think it was then that I began to develop a love for teaching. My doctoral work was on the coning stability and control of spinning spacecraft under thrust. This had to do with a problem NASA was having during orbital injection maneuvers. Spinning spacecraft were developing large coning motions during motor firings, and they didn't know why. We modeled the dynamics and ran some computer simulations and discovered that the nutational or coning mode of the spacecraft was interacting with the sloshing of some onboard fluids. We also discovered a way to attenuate or damp out that coning motion by designing a passive damping device and placing it at the right spot on the spacecraft. Well, my doctoral dissertation finally came together and I received the PhD in mechanical engineering from UCLA in 1992. I was looking for a teaching position that year, and I noticed an opening in the undergraduate engineering program at Oral Roberts University in Tulsa. I sensed a call to this university and joined the engineering faculty there in the fall of 1992. I continued to conduct research in the area of my doctoral work with ORU students. With grants and fellowships from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, the students and I built a test rig to model the dynamics and measure the stability and control of spinning spacecraft under thrust. This problem ended up fueling many senior projects in the engineering department for several years. It was quite an accomplishment for undergraduate engineering and physics students to develop this apparatus. It was pretty complex. It consisted of a spherical air bearing supporting a reconfigurable spacecraft model with an onboard computer, wireless communication units, remote-controlled mass balancing units, spin speed and attitude control systems, and rate gyros for attitude sensing. And the entire rig was mounted on a linear track on a large turntable, which had to spin in order to properly model the effect of a thrust or a follower force on a coning spacecraft. This turned out to be a great systems engineering project for the students because all these systems had to be engineered to correctly interface and work well together.
Dr. Halsmer, your research sounds like it's been absolutely fascinating, and I think it would be interesting for our listeners just to understand a little bit more what it means to try to stop the coning motion on a spinning spacecraft. What does it mean to be coning?
Well, when a spacecraft gets dropped off in low Earth orbit, it's usually a communication satellite with a perigee kick motor attached to it, and then it needs to go out to geosynchronous orbit, but the shuttle doesn't go all the way up there, so it's got to fire this motor to make this orbital injection to where it needs to go. Well, they typically spin this spacecraft with the motor attached about an axis and then spin it for stability purposes. But what we're seeing happening was this cone angle develop. In other words, in addition to the spinning motion, if you've ever played with a top, you know that when you first start to spin it, it spins nicely about a vertical axis, but then it can start to cone as the spin slows down. And if a satellite begins to do that during this orbital injection maneuver, and if the cone angle gets too large, it really just starts to approach a flat spin in which it's kind of tumbling end over end while the motor is firing, and you definitely don't want that to happen. You won't make it out to geosynchronous with that kind of maneuver.
Sure, this sounds like very important research for solving a problem like that, and this is really neat stuff you've been involved with. I want to ask you, how did you get interested in the debate over biological origins and the evolution of life originally?
Well, I've been aware of this debate ever since my college days, and I'd always been interested in it. But about 5 years ago, I began to sense our students needed to be better prepared to, well, give an answer to everyone who asks for the reason for their hope. I began to accumulate a reading list on the very broad topic of God as engineer and set aside time for study and dialogue with students in this area. I really wanted to see if engineers might have something valuable to contribute to the current science and theology discussions that were going on. Now there's over 1,000 books on this reading list now, and I've only been able to get to a fraction of them, but actually the students in my study group are helping me, and hopefully I'm helping them too. We've published several papers, and I feel like I'm pregnant with a book on this subject too. I think my experience with systems engineering has prepared me well to pursue this topic. I would love to start a center for science and theology here at ORU with a focus on systems engineering.
So what made you become a scientific skeptic of neo-Darwinian evolution?
Well, I'm skeptical of the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the fabulous engineering that we see. And we take this engineering for granted so often in living systems. Humanly engineered systems do not even begin to approach the magnificent systems engineering and levels of functional information found in living systems. I read some recent scientific articles claiming instead that living systems appear to be very poorly engineered and thus not consciously engineered at all. I just couldn't believe that the writer was making such a statement. Maybe I shouldn't expect scientists to appreciate the engineering intricacies involved in the miracle of life, but man, just open your eyes. Have you totally lost your sense of wonder, I was thinking? From an engineering perspective, living systems are amazing in the extreme. It's kind of reminiscent of Arthur C. Clarke's third law. I don't know if you've heard of this. This is a while back when he was writing science fiction and about future discoveries, but he said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Now, granted, living systems eventually die, but just look at how successful and stable life has been on Earth for so many years. Also, the physical death could possibly have been a part of the original engineering design. Even so, the system of life continues to thrive, and it appears to be very adaptable and robust. But it doesn't appear to have not been designed, not been engineered, I would say, or even to have been poorly engineered. Rather, what it strongly suggests to me by doing reverse engineering studies is that life is a system that has been meticulously engineered, admittedly by an as yet unknown process, but that it has undergone some kind of degradation or corruption. This is similar to the way the Antikythera mechanism was reverse engineered over a period of 100 years. The reason it took so long was that many centuries under the sea had caused a large amount of degradation and corrosion, but no one suggested that it had not been engineered or that it was poorly engineered, just that it was corrupted. They could easily see past the corruption to the magnificent engineering underneath. I think it's a similar situation with living systems. These systems were presumably engineered to be operated in a particular way for particular purposes. We should not be surprised then to discover that these systems have undergone corruption if they've been operated outside these parameters.
So why do you feel that intelligent design is a superior scientific explanation to Darwinian evolution?
Obviously, there's still a lot of uncertainty as to how extensively the process of evolution was involved in the development of the systems of life. But at this point, there appears to be ample evidence of an engineering influence or a calculating intentionality behind it all. And the fitness and the fine-tuning of the cosmos for life also point in this direction. I'm certainly open to any new scientific evidence that may come in, but currently the most coherent view of life and of the universe as a whole, to me, is that these are engineered systems. Just because it may be difficult or uncomfortable for us to envision the existence of such a powerful and incredible master design engineer behind it all does not mean we should ignore the evidence. In addition, just look at the success we have had in reverse engineering natural systems, especially living systems. I mean, systems biology confirms this approach every day. Scientists make the most progress when they treat living systems as if they have been engineered. That is, as if they have somehow been planned out ahead of time to achieve the functions that they serve. Engineers know that for someone to have any success in reverse engineering an object, there has to be a compatibility or a match between the complexity of the object and the ability of the person to comprehend that object, to tease it apart, and recognize the important relationships. We tend to take our ability to unravel the mysteries of nature for granted. The evidence from reverse engineering can be summarized as follows. Natural systems are so readily and profitably reverse engineered by human beings as to suggest that such systems were engineered in the first place. And to me, it doesn't seem to make sense to talk about an engineering influence without some kind of intelligence or intentionality associated with it.
Dr. Helsmer, it's always fascinating for me to interview engineers because it seems like engineers are so much better at recognizing design than scientists in many other fields. Do you feel like engineers have a very strong ability to see and recognize design?
Yes. In fact, this may be the important area that engineers have to contribute to this science and theology dialogue. I went through several years of engineering school, and what you learn is that it's very difficult to engineer something really well in a robust manner that can withstand disturbances. That's a very difficult problem. And so engineers are familiar with the difficulty associated with engineered systems, and they appreciate that. And so when they see that in nature, they think, wow, it strikes really a sense of wonder of how it could have come about. And engineers recognize that.
So, Dr. Halsmeyer, you obviously are the dean at a university, and I'm sure you spend a lot of time advising students and helping students. So what advice would you give to, say, an undergraduate or graduate student who is trying to pursue a career in the sciences today and might be a skeptic of Darwinian evolution? What would you tell them, and what advice would you give them?
One thing we have to remember is that we must learn to accept and be comfortable with a fair amount of uncertainty when it comes to objects as complicated as biological systems. We should take care to learn as much as we can from everybody we interact with, not just from those with whom we may agree. Too often we get into unhealthy disputes because we tend to overstate our case sometimes on a particular issue. It takes humility to admit our ignorance and our uncertainty, especially in our areas of expertise. But just remember that integrity, that is honesty, is our most important asset as scientists and engineers. We were engineered to be lovers of truth and seekers of truth, and to reliably convey truth to others. We dare not stray from these noble purposes.
Well, Dr. Halsmeyer, I really appreciate your time and your willingness to talk to our listeners on ID the Future about your own fascinating background in aerospace engineering and why you became a skeptic of Darwinian evolution. I look forward to talking to you some more about your paper in the International Journal of Design and Nature and Ecodynamics. So stay tuned for more with Dr. Dominic Halsmeyer. Thanks so much for coming on the show with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.